Clubhouse.
This is Caroline.
This is Paul.
And this is Mike. Welcome to the Third Day Podcast. Tonight we're talking about Episode 2, Saturday the Sun, Part 2 of the Summer Series. This episode was again written by Dennis Kelly and again directed by Mark Munden, just like Episode 1. Hey guys, what did you think of this very trippy episode? If Episode 1 was trippy, this was even trippier, I think.
I think we get a little further into how effed up Sam's head is. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if his head is like this off the island or if it's just maybe because he's on the island. It's getting worse, but he's starting to see more stuff. I mean, the acid didn't help, but there was still that heightened reality that we got in the first episodes just spread out to even more stuff, making it so that his reliability as a narrator, seeing people that he perceives as attacking him, even though that's what we're meant to believe as viewers, we're never sure. We're never sure that what he's telling us is everything, and what we're seeing through his eyes is actually truthful. So this episode can dug that hole deeper for us.
Hey, Caroline.
Yeah.
Do you know who should never do drugs, especially acid?
Oof, so many people.
Specifically, I'm thinking of Sam. Sam should not do drugs.
No, Sam I don't think so.
He is like the number one person. Like his picture should be on like all packaging for drugs.
Oh.
And like, do not sell to this man.
I have to say, this episode sucked me in, you guys. This made me so much more into the mystery of everything. I was piqued in the first one, but this one actually gave some answers. And I felt like we were given some real, true information that we could work on to untangle what's going on here.
It was one of those things where the answers we got kind of deepened the mystery. Like, we understand maybe some stuff that's happening now. Now you're asking, well, how did that come to be? We're deep now into kind of the lore of the island, of these people, of Sam, mythology-wise, just good crime mystery-wise. There's a lot of stuff going on here.
Can I ask you two guys, so if you were in the very sad and unfortunate situation of having a child that had been murdered, would you yourself seek revenge on the murderer?
Are you going to call names?
No. No, shithead.
Yeah, I think I would.
You should say shit for brains, like Mrs. Martin.
Shit for brains is a lot more fun. Yeah. Whenever I hear those stories of people that do that in real life, I put myself in the man's shoes to be like, would I do that? And I often think, yes, but not in a way that would get me caught right away. So Sam's idea of burning this, if this is true, burning a guy in his little trailer cabin thing on an island nobody goes to. Yeah, that's a great plan. I would do it that way for sure.
How about you, Mike?
I keep very few people really, really super close to me, and I spend a lot of energy then doing that and trying to keep those people safe. So I think I would definitely go and seek bloodlust, you know, fueled revenge if someone was to kill them, especially a six-year-old for no obvious reason. It just the most senseless and brutal of death. Yeah, I think I would go after him. Paul brings up a good question, because I agree with Paul. I don't think Sam is a very reliable narrator. I think you have to be really suspect of what he's seeing, of what he's saying. I don't disagree with the Martins and Jess in this episode when they're very skeptical of his encounters, though I think those encounters are maybe the most truthful things that have happened to him on the island. But I'm curious, what do you think, Caroline? Did he murder Goltan in the camper on the island and burn it up the way the episode kind of seems to lay out for us?
I'm going to take about two steps back in the story on that, and I'm going to tell you why I think he could have. So when he was explaining the story on the beach to Jess and explaining that the whole reason why they had been going somewhere that day was because he had made an arrangement to meet a guy who knew his grandfather. Then this guy doesn't show up, and then that's the reason why they end up at this fair where the child is snatched. All of those things to me feel like setup city. Like, again, going back to is the child running around on the island, luring him somewhere? He was obviously lured into this situation. And the grandfather and everything we knew about the grandfather having been on OC in his past for this military service, I'm like really feeling like it's starting to come together, the puzzle pieces for me. And yes, I actually do think that I think he did do it. I really think he did do it.
and just sort of blocked it out?
Probably.
Or maybe that, did you look up that episodic psychosis that he described?
I did. So on the beach, he actually discusses that idea that he had this psychosis where he was saying that the police and his family and everyone were lying to him that his son was even gone. And so during that time, he says, is a total blackout for him. Could he have easily during that time come to the island and done this to Goltan? Whether or not that trailer was pulled across the causeway and it happened over there and that's how it worked, or whether or not that camper was on the island, I don't know. But he could have brought it there to burn it. I don't know.
The episode starts with the vision or dream. Well, it's presented to us as a dream or nightmare about the camper burning, complete with a little bit of Jude Law's face melting off. But then the fact that he sees it again on the island during the day, I think I took that as kind of confirmation that is actually a thing that is really there. The lock on the door with the chain is a really specific thing to have in the dream and then to find at the site.
Right.
And when you add it together with the Mimir stuff later on, and being the coroner on the island, and we got a couple of mentions now that the woods where the murder took place and where Pona hung herself, it's been mentioned now a couple times that it's near where the causeway is. It is not actually far. It all kind of makes sense that this Romanian refugee would maybe have, you know, taken refuge on this island and was maybe living here as a squatter, and that Sam, you know, tracked him down and killed him here in his fugue blackout state.
And I'm even going to throw out that he could have even been living like in those woods, because if the kid was found in that river, he could have been living there. And if you were Sam and you were going to do something heinous, you might hook that camper to your car and pull it across the causeway and go burn it over on the isolated island. Like that, I'm just throwing that out there. I was like,
it's a stab.
Because it's when he could sort of remember it, but sort of not. Like he didn't know where he was. He just was trying to go somewhere isolated. So it was familiar, but it wasn't.
Were you guys surprised at all that the island, and whenever I say the island, I think I'm talking about Lost, but that the island has so many diverse bio areas, like biodome areas? I didn't realize that this place would have like such a wooded forest, like we seem to experience in this episode. When he leaves Mimir's little burnt out hut area, he's like walking through like trees and forest. I thought he had transported back to the mainland forest where the show began. But no, it's on the island, because then he pops up at the beach to find Jess. The geography of this place is kind of crazy. The for a place that's not terribly big, there's a lot of diverse biodomes going on OC.
Well, and for England, it's been pretty sunny.
That's also true.
Yeah.
One of the things that popped up on during he was talking about his reaction after his son died, he talks about the lying, that he accused people of lying to him. He was in denial about his son dying. All of that smacked kind of what we're seeing him going through on the island now, right?
Yeah,
He's accused a lot of people of lying in this episode. He accused a lot of people of lying, you know.
That kitchen scene in particular.
Very paranoid. I mean, he's coming off as a very paranoid kind of guy, which in those scenes actually make me believe him the most when he seems the most paranoid, but also kind of being in denial about a lot of things, though, too. So I thought it was an interesting parallel that he went through when his son died, and now he's gone through it, or seems to be going through it now that he's on this island, or reliving it, maybe.
Well, and it makes sense to me a little bit if you think about it if Epona was a trigger for him. So if that's the way you've dealt with the death of your son, and then now you are dealing with this tragedy of Epona that you think you're dealing with, right? You think it's happening, then maybe that would have triggered that paranoia and that confusion and stuff to kick back in.
Yeah, I think the Epona definitely seems to have been a trigger for him. But kind of like what you said, Caroline, about being Lord there, which is something that we even talked about in last week's episode. I think it's a very intentional trigger. I don't think it's a coincidence that she's in the woods at the start of the episode at the same time on the anniversary of his death that he's in the woods. You know, I think all of this is planned. For what reason? We don't know yet. Whether it's for revenge or for a sacrifice or for some kind of cleansing. Let's talk about grief, because grief was a recurring theme in this episode.
It's like the word of the day.
Especially on the beach. Yeah. Very much the word of the day. You know, I it was interesting that both conversations with Jess and Sam talking about the death of Nathan, the first part and then the second part, right, where he really got real. Like he's really real with her when he talks about the murder, the first part. And then the second part of that conversation also takes place on the beach where he talks about the rage. It's prompted again by Mrs. Martin she seems to be the angel of grief on this island. And she leans into him again in the kitchen, talking about, you know, that grief wants its pound of flesh, but that she says she's not going to let it happen here on the island. But she talks about grief almost like an old lover, whereas everyone else tends to talk about grief as something that you want to move past. Mrs. Martin seems to very much be willing to wallow in the grief and use it like a bomb. And I was curious what you thought about her reaction to grief. And then he says agony is bespoke. And he also talks about that grief is mostly just being lonely. Everyone has experienced grief at some point. I was curious how you guys squared the treatment of it in this episode.
For sure. I feel like that when he said the lines about that pain doesn't work that way, you can't share it. I think that that's something that Paul and I can definitely speak to the concept, especially with children and dealing with crisis and stuff. I feel like, yes, maybe we went through it together, but that doesn't mean that it's not the same pain 100% and then you split it 50-50 and you each carry the burden. You each still have 100% of the pain and you can't share it in that way. You can't split it up. And when he was talking about how like grief is lonely, I get that a lot. I'm recently going through a situation with one of our kiddos where I feel like I continuously keep going to people and trying to explain to them why it's upsetting to me. And they look at me and they're like, But it's like it ultimately ends up just being like me standing alone about it because it's my own grief and it's not something that I can hand off to somebody else to experience for me. I just have to deal with it myself. So for my own life, I can definitely respect Sam's take on all of this. Paul, what did you think about the Mrs. Martin portion adding in?
It's interesting. Her approach to it is that it's like whenever she gets Sam cornered, that's where she wants to go. She wants to bring up grief and I guess kind of the feelings that drive it in the way that it can drive you and that kind of stuff.
Almost like it's almost trying to exonerate him in a way.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Well, and allow him to feel it and let it control him, I guess, to some extent.
We'll give him license to let it control him, like permission, right? Like, hey, you know how that grief is kind of like driving you? Just let it drive. Just let it drive. It's fine. It's okay.
And it's you know, since she's married to Mr. Martin and everything that ever comes out of his mouth is, oh, it's not so bad. Oh, that's a great guy. You know, he's like the silly... He's the silly sausage of the pair. It's funny that they're very, very, very much a yin yang together in very extreme ways. One only wants to talk about grief. One only sees happiness and goodness, or at least pretends to.
Right. Well, that's the key, though, right? I think Mr. Martin is as false and insincere as it gets on this island. And conversely, I think Mrs. Martin is as real as it can be, you know? And I think last week I talked about kind of how Nathan was maybe the avatar for the island, the soul of the world, as it turns out OC is. But I think maybe Mrs. Martin is too.
So you're absolutely 100 identifying the boy in the red shorts as his son.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's unquestionable to me at this point that he is the son that he's seeing.
And he's alive or he's not alive?
No, I don't think he's alive. I don't think he's alive. Okay.
Just trying to make you had never called him anything. We were calling him the boy with the red shorts and now you're calling him Nathan. So just making sure you're calling him the same thing.
Well, to be fair, I think last week I think we were saying that it seemed like he was maybe the ghost or ghost of his son, but we got a name for the son this week. That's the only reason I'm using Nathan because I feel like we have a name now from his story with Jess. We know his son's name is Nathan, so that's why I'm using it. Yes, but the boy in the red shorts and the boots. You know, but I think maybe Mrs. Martin is another part of the island's aspect. The idea of you can heal here, whereas maybe Mr. Martin is more of the island bloodlust part of it.
I'm going to maybe even add in the man-woman part to that, too, because I think that Mrs. Martin and Jess
like that.
Really talk a lot the same to him. I think they speak to him more directly and appeal to him like, Well, let's talk about it. Well, let's get to the bottom of this. How are you feeling? Like, they're doing that. Well, Mr. Martin is always like, let's not talk about it. It's cool. Go to the causeway if you want to. And like, but he's trying to manipulate him as much as the women are. They're just doing it in two different ways.
Let's talk about Jess, because offline, Caroline, you said something very interesting about Jess that I would like to delve into. Jess took a really big active role in the show tonight, starting with them when they wake up in bed together and whether or not they had sex. Well, let's start there. Did they have sex? You know, was there enough conclusive proof that these two fucked?
No, I don't think that they did have sex. The fact that she found tissues, I don't care. I don't trust her anymore. I'm going to direct you to a conversation that they had on the beach that immediately made me go, what? I'm going to tell you it now because I don't want you guys to be all like, what is she talking about? When he was like speaking about recognizing the island and she goes, you know, you haven't been here, right? She doesn't know him. She doesn't know him. So that line doesn't make any fucking sense. And as soon as she said that and then says, you should go, and then kisses him, I'm like, you're a harpy. I know your shit. You're doing some siren song here. I know what you're doing. And I see you, Jess, which sucks because I like her. She had a lot of really funny lines in this episode that were delivered impeccably, but she is on my radar. She's the gaslighting fucking queen.
The notes I wrote, I had, these two have a fast bond. Is Jess sincere or is she complicit in the island's plans for Sam? Because she is so like down to ride, you know, like ride or die with Sam, and they've literally known each other like 12 hours.
Well, and I'm going to go with, there's other moments too. She's the one who says, you know what? You should go talk to Mamir. Oh, wow. Okay. That like pushed him right one direction. The thing is that complicit with the island, I'm not so sure. I think somehow involved in whatever the fuck is going on with Sam, yes. But I feel conflicted things there with her. The way she's talking, like I said, you should go to the causeway, then kisses you. I think that that's real. I don't think she's faking that. I think she feels both ways, which makes me wonder what is going on with Jess. I don't know. She does want him to leave, but she does want him to stay.
It's like when he's riding in with Epona, she says, I think you should go. And he's like, I'm not going. And she's like, okay, then come on. Then they get a little further and she's like, no, really, I think you should turn around. And then he's like, no. And they go, okay, let's go to the Martins. It's same kind of pattern.
Yeah, all the women do this, actually. All of them. but this Jess situation, like, I do think she's a part of this story in this whole luring, but I feel so much more conflicted. The Mamir part made me be like, why would she tell him to go to the place where now it's revealed that Mamir knows about them and knows about the sun and the trailers here and all that stuff. Like, it's like she wanted him to find that.
Yeah, the Mamir stuff definitely confirms that there is a larger plot having to do with Sam in terms of the residents of the island, maybe the consciousness of the island, if we want to go to that spot. But yeah, there's more than one person involved here.
It took like three times for me to hear them say that he was the coroner on the case for their family. It took me like three times because it was like the archaeologist thing stuck, then the doctor thing stuck, and then the coroner thing stuck, and it was like, coroner of what? What? Like,
in some great acting, a little bit of acting, when she says Mamir, he makes a face right away, and it's not the first time there's been a spark of recognition on the face of one of the characters. So instantly you know that name means something to him. But again, he says, but I don't know why. And again, not the first time that he's done that. Like, that rings the bell to me, though I can't tell you why it rings the bell to me. After he goes through the study and he sees all of the kind of very, very anatomical kind of drawings and sketches and goes through the whole thing, that he puts it and finds the article, he puts it all together that Mamir was the coroner in the case. He would only maybe know the name and not the face, because we learn they never actually saw their child. They never saw, well, interesting, now that I'm saying it out loud, they never saw a body. And genre-wise, if you don't see a body, you know, who knows what's really going on?
Who knows what's really going on? And I do want to talk about that moment, because in the last episode I said guilt on accident when we were talking about the river, and I said maybe he's feeling guilt, and then I was like, I don't know what part he played, but then now to know that he took a phone call and that's when his son went missing.
How many fucking tense phone calls does Sam take in a day? I mean,
well, do you guys think we're going to get some background as to like what's with him in real life? Like, what's with these tense phone calls? What's with the meeting up with the grandfather's friend who he doesn't even know? Like, what is going on back
then? The grandfather's friend isn't fully explained, but you could imagine, you know, if he was the equivalent of something like a social worker at that time in his life.
And he did say that, right?
Like, I could imagine high stakes phone calls coming in at inconvenient times.
I suppose that's true. You're right. That's true.
You know, interesting, because I took it as it was related to the guy standing him up and not showing him up. I took it as part of the lore.
I took it part of the setup, that it was like a distraction.
Right. Yeah. I took it as part of the trap also. Oh, that
I thought he was just straight up ditched.
Well, no, that he ditched. Well, yes. And so it led to a phone call of, like, you know, where didn't you show? You? Like, yeah. You're supposed to be here.
Yeah.
Sam seems the kind of guy, like, everything is kind of a personal affront to Sam.
But it would have kept him busy and distracted, because he would have been talking to this guy. And everyone would have known that. And you would have known that he was distracted at this exact time. Like, you could cue the deer or the Gultan. Because you knew that he was on the phone yelling. So you knew he wasn't paying attention to the kid.
That's a funny farm joke for the fans keeping track of the puns out there.
You like the cue the deer action. I'm not sure that's a pun.
Okay, the references. The references.
Can I drop a little mythology on you guys with Mimir?
Lay it down.
So a lot of the mythology we've heard in the show so far is Celtic, or from the Gauls, in that part of the world. Mimir is actually a figure in Norse mythology. He is heavily associated with wisdom and having knowledge. He was unfortunately beheaded during one of the many wars that the Norsemen and the Vikings would have. Odin, finding his beheaded body, grabbed his head, embalmed it, magicked it, carried Mimir's head around with him forevermore. Because of the spells he put over it, Mimir was able to impart secret knowledge and wisdom to Odin. So he was kind of like a portable head, like advisor to Odin, and a good one at that. The name Mimir, down through the ages, has been translated to be associated with the word memory. And it's also associated with thinking and recall and reflection. This character, who maybe is a connection, that it gives Sam a connection to why he knows the island, is named Mimir, that has this secret knowledge that provides this level of counsel to Sam without really saying much. He's also known to have been a drinker of mead on a regular basis. And when we see Mimir in this episode, he was stone cold drunk.
Yeah, he was a mess for sure.
He got a bottle in his hand, like a claw. I mean, he doesn't have much. He has a nice tie, and he's got a bottle in his hand.
That's awesome. I think that is helpful, because there is definite little parts there. I do feel like he's like a guidepost in some weird way for Sam, and Jess sent him there. What do you think it meant when Mimir said, "What did they do to you?"
I think it was interesting that Sam's response is, he takes that in stride, and his response is, "What did you do to me?"
What do you guys make of that interaction? What does it mean?
I have no idea. I was hoping you guys knew, because I wrote it in my notes too.
What do you think, Paul?
I understood in that moment the they to be other islands folk.
Okay.
But that then creates an expectation of, in my mind, that the islands folk, if they haven't done anything to him yet, then there's going to be something that they're going to do. Like, there's a plan. He just doesn't know. He just doesn't even know what day of the week it is.
I feel like the what did you do to me? That part didn't seem odd, because that was like he was holding the article in his hand. And so for him to say, what did you do to me? I mean, it does seem like you're connected to this. You're obviously connected to this. You know, what the hell? What did you do? But I think the whole this just speaks to that larger conspiracy setup, gaslighting. You know, how did they get you here? What did they do to you?
Some more interesting things, and Caroline, I thought of you in this scene because you host decorating the set from Hollywood to Your Home with Beth Kushnick. Mimir's little hut of horrors here, I found fascinating. This was a set decorator's dream.
There were so many
little dusty bottles and little nooks and crannies. I was freeze framing every half second, looking for like little clues to see what I could figure out on the screen as it was rolling by.
So we were talking about this because of the history that we know on the island. At first, I kept saying it was maybe it would look like an abandoned greenhouse, but Paul made a good connection.
I thought it was more connected to the World War II stuff, like barracks
It was barracks.
It looks like a greenhouse from the outside.
Yeah, but that was some great storytelling. Remind us, hey, remember the war? Remember the military was here? Remember his grandfather was here? It was just keeping that in my head. Only by showing a building reminded me that his grandfather was on OC, which then to remind me that the grandfather was involved on the day of the fair, that was the grandfather's friend. Those little tiny nuggets were practically unspoken, and yet they were like right in my head, you know? They were helping the dots.
And a grandfather who, just from the way he talks about him, obviously spoke a lot about his life, but never spoke about his time on OC. You know, there's some good parts to Sam spouting every aspect of his life to everyone who he runs into.
Right.
And I thought that was like a really interesting little nugget that his grandfather, other than saying he was stationed on the island during the war, the fact that he never spoke about it. And, you know, the Greatest Generation, they talk about their experiences. So it's interesting that he would not talk about his time on this home base, you know, station there.
To your point, though, from a set decor, you know, standpoint, I think that they did an amazing job of making everything look extremely lived in and old and been there for forever. The smallest of details, even things that, like, I was noting that when Sam came outside the door and he was, like, standing outside and his head was taller than the roof of the porch, there was, like, these little things that you were like, wow, this place has been around that long enough that people were littler, you know, that it was interesting. I liked a lot of the things about the set.
I bet the barracks were real. They were really on the island, because we've seen elsewhere where HBO has shot. We saw where they shot a sequence in The Leftovers that in The Leftovers, it plays one way. But when you see it in real life, you realize this place should be fucking condemned and just rolled over. It was the barns and stuff. Remember the barns from the second season of The Leftover where the girls were kept in the in the trailer or the camper?
Like, so we went there. We went there. Those actual barns.
Oh, wow.
And there's on premises apartments and things where it looks kind of just like this, where like the roofs were completely caved in, but there was still furniture, like magazines and books and dolls and shit in there.
Yeah, it was creepy as shit.
And as you got too close, you could get kind of this moldy, if I breathe this too long, I'm getting cancer kind of smell. I could imagine that the conditions in Mimir's abode were probably similar to that.
Yeah.
And the point of bringing that up is I bet that's a real place and HBO used it.
And good on them for using a real location. Again, I think that adds a really cool layer to this show, and that they kept the name and they kept the details that are real, because they could have called it, you know, a Hobbiton or whatever and made it something different, but they didn't. And that makes you actually think, like, could this be real? You know, like, there's enough weird things that are real.
I feel like you're intimating that you don't think Hobbiton is not real. So we need to have a discussion about that offline.
You want to know something that's so sad about me? I said that not even really knowing if it was a place. I just made up a silly word that I think I've heard.
Oh, my God.
And there you go.
You're not welcome in the Shire.
That's fine.
We already have plane tickets to Hobbiton
now. I have
now.
Enough tiny people in my life.
Well, you know, interesting. For the first time, I watched all the way through the credits of this episode. I hadn't yet watched them. I didn't watch them after the first episode. But there is an OC Island logistics captain in the credits. So the fact that you say that, Paul, is interesting, because they probably did shoot on the island. This probably is an old barracks, because OC really was an army base for the British during World War II. It definitely seems to lend credibility. The same way on Lost, it was not uncommon to see real things in Hawaii, because they used to shoot on location in Hawaii.
Can we run back to Mimir real quick? Because I really honestly think that trying to figure out the structure of who's on what team and who's against Sam and who's with Sam and whatever, I really thought that our time there helped a lot. I feel like Mimir is on the side of Sam. I think that Larry and the hooligans are definitely not. And they are definitely in on whatever. And having had Larry do our reverse sign of the cross with Mr. Martin makes me know that Larry and Mr. Martin are on that team over there.
In my notes, I called them droogs, but Caroline doesn't remember what droogs are.
What do you mean Caroline doesn't remember what droogs are?
You're the one that showed me Clockwork Orange in the first place. And you're like, I've never seen Clockwork Orange.
I've absolutely never seen it. What part of Caroline? Okay, listen, you two know me enough on this podcast. Now,
I find it highly suspect that you would ever have watched Clockwork Orange.
Thank you. I absolutely never would have sat through that movie. You know, I'm scared of this show.
In my notes, though, I did call them Larry and the Droogs.
Well, I'm calling them Larry and the Hooligans, because I've been listening to a lot of 60s music, and that seems right on.
I was calling them the priests.
That's not nearly as fun as the hooligan.
Priests aren't fun.
The priest of the Azus Trinity. But before we get to Larry, because I think we got to talk about Larry. Larry's got some anger issues. Mimir, though, just going back on the mythology thing and the being a focal point of memory and reflection, the drawings on his table, these were things that Sam has experienced on the island since we've been with him on the show. Mm-hmm. There's a picture of the cricket. There was a picture of the dissected rabbit. The dissected rabbit picture was attached to the figure of a human dissection, or the beginning of a human dissection, like anatomical drawing, which we saw a little bit at the start of this episode in his dream, you know, where he's back wearing the bear shirt in the cave and he's ripping at his insides. And it's kind of like the incision mark that a human would have. And at the end of the episode, very explicitly has the incision mark. So it's interesting that Mimir has these things in his workshop that Sam is actually experiencing on the island. Almost as if Mimir is some kind of like literal cloud storage for Sam's mind. He has in his place like physical mementos of the things Sam has experienced in his time on the island. Because those are some odd things to have, coincidentally, that Sam has also seen while he's been there. And then runs into another dissected rabbit in the same style right outside of Mimir's hut as he's running from Larry and the Droogs.
I want to throw out an idea here, and I'm not going to follow this path, but I'm going to put a sign up for whomever wants to follow this path. Like the idea that they made Mimir a coroner, and the idea of dissection and the idea of rabbits, because we've all already talked about the fertility issues and we know that rabbits have a large amount of offspring. You could go down the path of, is he investigating the bodies to figure out like, why are they not reproducing, or why, what is going on with this, like a healthy one or a not healthy one or whatever. And he's a weirdo and he throws them out into the grass when he's done. So we're always taking them as sacrifice and this really special thing. But given that they made him a coroner, and given that these fertility problems are there, and given exactly where they cut them on the torso, if you wanted to take the path of like, could there be some other things going on? You could. I'm going to continue down the, this is about sacrifices, but I think that that's an interesting layer.
I think we hit on the fertility thing last week, and I stand by that. I think that's an issue on the island.
I don't mean that the fertility is not, maybe not an issue. What I mean to say is that combination of things, coroner, rabbit, fertility, could these dissection pictures be that?
Because Jess mentions in a very odd kind of way at the beginning of the episode, like the fact that they didn't use a condom, and I thought the condom conversation was pretty funny, was because she gets pregnant at the drop of a hat, and she has this whole story around being pregnant, kind of trapping her in her marriage. I thought it was really odd, but then also not, because I think there is an undercurrent here that, again, not clear to me yet, but there is an undercurrent here about fertility and childbirth and life and death going on, playing on this island. And I think Jess is tied into that. I don't think that was a throwaway line. I think this is one of those shows where there are really no throwaway lines.
But I think it goes back to what Paul was saying about, not that anything was throwaway. I'm saying that everything is double meaning.
Yeah.
That
making him
a coroner doing dissections doesn't have to be gross. Especially if you knew there was fertility issues, he might be dissecting bodies to figure out who is working correctly and who isn't. That's plausible.
One more thing about Mimir and memory. It's also in Mimir's hut where he finds the article and he sees the picture of Goltan sitting outside his camper. He connects it because there's the same sigil in the picture that he now remembers from his dream. And he's about to go find on the island the camper that was burning. So again, Mimir's hut serves as like this load station of memory for Sam. It just again, reinforcing the idea that I think he needed to go to Mimir, which makes me think that Jess is maybe on his side if you're going to do the battle of, you know, you're either with us or against us.
I think conflicted.
But she sent it to the Mimir, and to the extent that regaining your memory is a good thing, going to see Mimir seems to have been a good thing, right? He is putting pieces together that he wouldn't have otherwise had. Oh, did you guys catch what Sam's last name is?
Well, I read it in the notes. It says Dawson's.
There's a picture of Jude Law in the lower right-hand portion of the article, and it says, "Devastated, Sam Dawson."
My thoughts on Mimir are mostly in terms of like sides or what he's trying to do goes back to what he's done for Sam that we actually saw. One was when he saw his face, it was like he couldn't pull himself together. It wasn't fear. It seemed to be elation running over so that he couldn't even form words. Happiness, right, in such a way that I don't know if I've ever experienced that level where I just couldn't think. And when the Droogs show up, he shoos Sam away for his safety. He knows that those guys can't see him. And I don't get the sense that it's because seeing him there would be bad. It's just seeing him at all would be bad.
Oh, I think also seeing him there would be bad. But because they say, have you been talking?
Have you been talking? And I took that, I think the same as you, Caroline. Yeah. Have you been talking to Sam?
But you could go double again. I mean, the show is very good at this, right? Because you could say he shoved Sam out for Sam's safety, but he also shoved Sam out for his own fucking safety. Sure. He doesn't want Larry to kill him. So which is it? Don't know. Or which is it more of? I don't know.
I want to go back to the idea of the unfit narrator, the unreliable narrator. Is Jess a reliable narrator? Because she tells us the story, or she tells Sam the story, and we get to hear about how she doesn't drink and she doesn't fuck because she doesn't want to be seen as an unfit parent. Basically, the only things we've seen her do on the island is maybe fuck and definitely drink and do drugs. Is she reliable? Does she really think of herself as someone who doesn't drink and doesn't do things that would jeopardize her time with her kids? Because she really emphasizes that a lot. But then that's basically all she kind of does.
Well, that's probably the big fat question mark with her and what she's doing there. Does she have a specific role related to Sam? Does she keep insinuating herself into his path on purpose? Or is it some other thing that's more genuine where, you know, it's coming from just happenstance or something? We haven't seen enough just yet, but she does keep weaving back in. Ostensibly, she's supposed to stay there until this festival really happens. It makes sense that she'd still be hanging around and all that, but she doesn't need to hang out with him, right?
Yeah.
If she's there to study the island and the people.
What did you think, Caroline? Because you're a people person and you know, you're someone who likes to help people. What did you think of her jumping up and helping Sam bar the door before even asking questions on why they were barring the door? She jumped up and started pushing that dresser in front of it without really questioning it. And then, you know, then Sam, are we going to hurt people kind of thing? Like, she was really ready to go stand next to him.
So there's a movie called Riding in Cars with Boys with Drew Barrymore. And one of the lines in that is, if in order to get through to a woman, all you have to do is ask for her help. If you ask for her help, she's going to help you. I won't explain the plot of that movie, but that always stuck with me because it was like the way that he basically ends up breaking the ice with her is to ask for her help. In this case, because men hesitate to ask for help so much, the way that he comes in and he's like, help me. I honestly don't know any woman who wouldn't start pushing on the dresser. I really don't. If you're scared and you're a man, I'm probably two times as scared as you are because I'm kind of hoping you're going to help me. If you're telling me to bar the door, I'm going to push on the door, even if I haven't heard your story yet. So that part didn't seem off to me at all. But I would gather if it was man to man, I kind of think you're insinuating. If a guy came in and said, help me push on this, would you do it right away or would you?
I mean, I don't know that I have the same take as you. I think if a guy came running in, I would expect the woman to be like, you know, grab a weapon to protect yourself against the crazy man ranting would be my instinct.
Oh, against Sam?
He seems unhinged when he comes running in there. And it's a fact
but that's the trick, Mike. He asks for her help. Why it works. There is a special trigger inside women's head that if you ask for their help, you know, all the serial killers of the world, they don't just snatch. They say, could you help me put my groceries in the car?
It's true. It's how the senator's daughter gets kidnapped in Silence of the Lambs.
It's how...
Could you help me put the couch inside the van?
Yeah. But isn't it Gacy, who's the same thing? He had like a van and he had groceries and he would act like he had like a crutches. And he'd be like, could you help me put this in? And that's how he would get the women close enough to do it. And no, it didn't surprise me at all that asking for help made her come to his side. She wasn't scared of him at all. She was scared of whatever was on the other side. That's how I would feel.
It just endeared her to me. I agree with you. I think there are question marks about her sincerity and about being torn, and I agree with all that. I still like her. I like her because that she jumped up and did it. That made me like her. I like the fact that she takes a weapon and says to him, Sam, are we going to hurt people? Like, she's ready to, like, fucking go to the mattresses with this guy who she doesn't know. What did you think, Paul? Would you expect someone to jump up and help you if you came in ranting and raving about
needing
help?
Is it a guy-girl thing? I'm curious what you thought.
Yeah, if I'm Sam, but then my mind is already kind of foggy, I believe, and it's just been experiencing these kind of larger than life moments. I mean, that when that motorcycle piece hits the tree and it sounds like a car dropping off off the roof, that's one of those moments where I'm not sure what to believe, the way that it's shown on camera, because that's what Sam thinks he saw, or what, because that looked too heavy for a man to throw whatever that thing was. And to hit that hard. But if I'm Sam, yeah, if I run in their room and I ask for help, I guess I would be expecting it. One way or the other, I'm still pushing that thing in front of the door, with or without her.
For Jess, I'm going to go back to the part where I feel like she is conflicted. I feel like she was asking him questions when she was pushing the dresser at the same time, but she was pushing the dresser. That's the conflict. And also, she had some really amazing lines in this that I loved. I thought the funniest moments, they actually had some funny moments, was when she was like talking about the fact that all these people make her feel so comfortable and now they've discovered that she's a whore.
I laughed
for
a
like
lot.
5 minutes, and then later when he saw her on
the
beach,
she's like, "And they've discovered I'm a whore." Like the way she says
the
it,
delivery
really,
was fantastic. And then same on the beach when she's like, "I'm sitting here hiding my slutty face." All that, like, I laughed so many times. I thought, again, we were talking about the actress last week. I really feel like Catherine is kicking ass on this one. No matter how I feel, here's the deal: I'm not like Team Sam because I don't know what the fuck's up with Sam either. So I'm just saying, I think she's conflicted. She is playing some multiple games here, having to do with Sam. But I'm not saying that that makes her a bad person. Not at all. I just think that that she's not being straightforward with whatever she's really doing here.
I liked her before that, after they have their little explosion about the condoms, and then she comes downstairs and she's a little more composed. And he asks her, he starts to apologize, and they talk about regret, and she says to him, you know, I don't regret it. I don't regret it one little bit. And she gives him kind of like a little smile, and in the whole scene I found very sexy, but also very, I don't want to say a word endearing again because I have already used that, but I found it very...
I know what you're talking about. It felt like he was making her feel safe about what had happened. So there was something about that whole thing, because he was like, your husband's not here. No one has to know. And it was like, smile. We're all safe. It's okay. I get it that your husband's a dick.
The way she just says, you know, but I don't regret it. You know, like, don't get me wrong. Everything I'm saying aside, I don't regret it. I don't regret it one little bit. It just was like really kind of sexy, I found, and very sweet. I found that whole moment very sweet between them. You know, these two have a very kind of kismet, a fate mandated kind of vibe about them.
Well, which makes me wonder, what other kind of connections do they have? Like, because everybody else seems to likely have connections to him. I'm curious where Jess comes. If, you know, if Mimir was in his real life, does Jess come into play anywhere in real life?
I just had the wildest thought ever.
Uh-oh.
Lay it on us.
Sam has two daughters and a son, but the son presumably is the son who's passed away. Jess has two daughters, no son. Jess has a husband, a do-nothing husband. What if Sam and Jess are actually married? What if this is an elaborate game of come into the bar and act like you don't know me kind of thing? You see that in TV, you see that in movies, kind of like apparently like couples trying to spice it up by acting like they don't know who each other are. Except for Sam's not really acting, but Jess is. What if they're both talking about the same things? Maybe they have the same exact experiences.
So this is like a Shutter Island sort of thing. Shutter Island is that movie with Leonardo DiCaprio. It's a Scorsese film. And it starts out with him and his partner. They're FBI agents, I believe, if I recall. And they arrive to an island where there is an asylum. I think it might have been one of the ones off New York City, in fact.
That would be Roosevelt Island.
I believe that's right. And they start to investigate this homicide. All of the normal stuff that you expect in a cop show, none of it really works. Like him being able to call on witnesses to try to get their statements and investigate in a way that feels very familiar are all impeded in one way or another. Just people that should be there aren't there, or they just kind of give lame answers to his questions and stuff. And he's taking it all very seriously. To go much further than that, I would ruin the whole story for you. The tie-in is that there's a whole memory aspect where he believes he's going through everything he's going through, and it's revealed later that it's not quite what he thinks it is. So who knows?
So who knows? That literally just hit me while I was listening to you talk, because it would explain a lot of how she's kind of coquettish with him, where if you view it from play acting, you know, like, oh, my husband's going to kill me. My husband always finds, you know, like all of that husband talk. Where, again, how would your husband know? He's not on this island. Like, how would he know kind of thing? Like all the kind of winking and nodding stuff from her point of view, not realizing how seriously he actually is a being about all this stuff, that he doesn't have a fucking clue what's going on.
I don't think that they're married.
I don't really think that either, but I think it's a fun theory.
I think it's another one of those, like, for listeners, I mean, put up the sign and put the path. Like, if you want to head that way, go that way. I don't think I'm going that way, but I think that it's a fun and interesting theory that, like, maybe there's more than one story going on here. Different whatevers, you know, old lost brought us to different timelines and different whatever. We don't know what the fuck. Oh, one more scene that I loved with her was when just that was that acid scene. talk about coquettish, when she's like dancing around and like luring him back and making him smile and stuff. I mean, she lured him back to the island. He went halfway down the causeway. He could have left. Dude, but it was Jess that brought him back. So that's huge. When he goes, "How old are you?" And she goes, "How old are you?" That I like cracked up. I was like, I love this. Because you know what? I asked you guys that last time. How old are the Martins? Remember I asked you that? So when they were joking about how old are you? I don't know. How old are you? That was like, what the fuck? What if he is like 1,000 years old? We go back to this again. I don't know. I'm just saying.
When he comes back in the pub and now it's filled up with people because all these fuckers drink like to excess every night, and he makes eye contact with her. She like makes eyes at him and then like raises a beer with like a little smile because she's talking to her friends. I got a total boner. That was so hot. These two have like the sexiest chemistry for two schleppy looking people. Not that she's looking schleppy, but like they're not like done up like hot starlet celebrities. But I find their chemistry very, very enticing. My favorite line of her is right before they do the acid, and she's trying to convince him, and she says, you know, there's something special about this place. And then she goes into this whole thing about who are you? Tonight, you don't need to be a husband who something horrible happened to. You could be whoever the fuck you want to be tonight. That whole scene, I've never done a drug in my life. I've never smoked a cigarette in my life. I think maybe listening to her, I think maybe I do the acid.
She could convince you. I even loved her like body language. I love that she like flopped back in the grass when she said that and stuff. Like I loved
everything about
everything,
her.
All the way that she played it. I was like, you are convincing me. I need some acid. Where is this acid,
that doesn't
Jess?
Look so bad.
No, it looks like fun. Can I do it with her?
What's the significance of the cricket being alive and jumping away right before she comes up to him in that scene? That's the first time we've seen the cricket actually move since the show started. Is it significant that there's life in that cricket right before he's about to have this kind of good special moment? He's like staring out on the ground, and just as she kind of like scares him a little bit as she like taps him on the back because he's staring at the cricket, like, and it jumps away. Just as she kind of comes up to him, and then they have that whole conversation that leads to the acid.
If I was reading into that with my crystal ball, knowing how the rest of the episode goes, I would only suspect that that means that the cricket, in its infinite wisdom, is saying, you should really get going now.
Nice.
Did Caroline, because you were picking up on Jess and her duplicity, maybe, and her being torn, did you notice that she says exactly the same thing that Mr. Martin said last episode? He asks her back at the beach, he goes, how's Epona? And she says, alive, because of you. That, I think that's a verbatim thing that Mr. Martin says to Sam outside the pub where they're trying to get the car to get out of the way so he can make it to the causeway.
And I think it's a very weird thing to say. I mean, if I was like,
I was like,
hey, how's Joe? And you're like, alive. You're like, what the fuck? Like, what? Stop that. Like, you'd be like, oh, feeling better today.
We were all assuming alive.
I know. Like, you didn't need to yell that. That felt weird. Yeah, I think that that's an oddity there. Every single character on the show doesn't neatly fit in a box all the time, but Jess is the most waffling for me between like pros and cons.
There's an interesting thing, Paul. You brought up Roosevelt Island. Roosevelt Island is this really weird island that sits between Manhattan and Queens in the East River in New York. And it's had a history. It's been a women's prison. It's been an asylum. It's been a private hospital. If you go there, it is one of the creepiest, spookiest places I've ever driven. I haven't actually been there in about 15 years because the place freaks me so much. You have to take like a little bridge to get there from the Queens side. And once you cross onto the island, only like one half of the island is inhabited. And there are big buildings. And when you're driving down, there's just one street. And when you're driving down it, you get the feeling that they're all false fronts, that if you were to walk through the door of any of these buildings, you would be like out in the open, like a set on like an Old West kind of thing. And the people all look like they're from like central casting. They're all like background actors, background artists. And it's the creepiest fucking place. Like you've driven onto a movie set, except for you have no idea what play is going on, what is happening. You just know you don't want to be there. There are so many aspects to OC that feel like that. That when people say things like, alive because of you, you know, like like she's got like sides like hidden in her like, you know, in like her pocket where she has to like read her line before she right. says it.
If Epona's brought up, mention that she's alive.
Yeah. And it's because of you. You know, right, so right. about yourself.
Right. All of the above. That's
yeah. And it just, you're talking about Roosevelt, made me think of that. Like it has a real fake play quality to it. And we were talking about the play nature of the dialogue and some of the staging. But I'm starting to think that's actually more a feature of the island and not like of the dialogue of the show. You know what I mean?
Yeah, not of the writers. That because they came from a theater background, we were thinking maybe they were kind of injecting that.
Like almost like the Truman Show. Truman is, you know, Truman has to stay on his script. And if they're not good at ad-libbing, opponent's going to come up. So everyone knows when it does to tell.
Alive!
Because of you! You know?
It's your cue.
That's who.
Exactly.
Let's talk about Epona a little bit, because we see her again later in this episode. But before then, Sam, because he's always asking about Epona, asks Mrs. Martin when she brings him those bright orange sneakers.
Which, that was so weird. Why would she even own? Look at what they all wear. They wear like gray, brown clothes. Every single one of them. You know what?
The salt in the sea. There's no bright orange.
And
in the,
bright,
you know,
orange shoes. Right. All I can figure is, would that not make you the easiest thing to track? You could see them across the island.
I have trail sneakers that are that color, and one of the things about it is like, when you're covered in mud doing like a mud run or something, you want like a bright orange sneaker so people can see you, you know?
Or if you were lost in the woods, they could spy you from like a million yards because it's so not nature like.
Or they match the color of the cricket.
Ooh.
That is very true. I like that a lot.
What if we starting to outfit him in cricket colors? That's not good.
Oh, what if he's got little spider beetles who were back in this episode?
If they give him like a sweatshirt that's orange next, and then slowly by slowly, each piece of clothing turns orange.
They start feeding him little eggs to put in the stomach. But she says that, you know, they've taken note of what he said about what she went through. They were definitely intimating something else, right? Something about Jason or something. And Jason, we see later, is being punished. But she says they're talking to her up at the big house. Who the fuck is they? Who's the they? I mean, Colonel Sanders, presumably, but who is the they? Seems to see more than one person.
I think it's the powers that be of the island and the white suit man for sure.
The whole structure of this island seems to exist outside of any normal governmental jurisdiction or anything like that. Yeah. Like, we haven't seen actual police or anything suggesting that there's traditional law and order other than the customs of the people on the island. So all that stuff when she's at the big house, blah, blah, blah. You know, if this is truly all done with her, then why isn't she back home? What interest is anybody in this big house have anything to do with this teenage girl and her attempted suicide? How is that even a thing that she would go there?
And that's why I go back to that conversation that we had in the last one where I said, before we vilify Jason, who are our other players in this? We know that Mr. Martin is hanging out with Larry. We know these people are crazy. I understand he was calling people in the big house cunts. I get it. But maybe they are cunts. Like, right. Why are we siding on the side that they're not, you know? And so I'm like, huh, you know, maybe Jason's not wrong about this.
Well, getting a look at that tent revival and seeing the front side of Colonel Sanders didn't make me not think he was a cunt.
Oh, my God. That was very heel this man, huh?
So I have a whole theory about Epona and why people hate Sam and they're mad at him and why the big cast would be involved. Before we get there, because I think that's really the last thing to talk about, is that whole the tent revival, which plays into the Izu stuff that Jess talks about on the beach, which plays into Larry and his fish head that he's walking around with and his buddies. That's all connected, I think. And so I want to get to that last, because I think we're just about done with the episode. But why on earth does she kiss him at the end and apologize to him? Because I don't think she's apologizing to him for not taking his side in the kitchen about being scared of her dad. She seems to be apologizing to him for something else. And I don't know what else that she might be apologizing. And then she fucking kisses him on the mouth, which... I mean, I talked about how I thought there were some weird, like, pedophile-y things with him last week, and obviously Larry seems to feel the same way.
I think she could be saying sorry for luring you here in the first place. I think she could be saying, I know what I'm going to do when I kiss you. I know that everybody in this entire town is going to turn their eyes onto you the second I do it. And so, sorry, kiss, run away. I think that there's a whole plan that's happening. I think they want to sick Larry onto him. But I don't know exactly why Epona would want to do that. But it felt that way. I mean, as a woman, if I were with somebody, say I was at a bar or something, and knowing my person that I'm with there sees that or sees him grab me, probably he's going to get punched in a minute, but maybe I could be like, oh, sorry. Mm-hmm, and like kind of start something happening that's going to end up getting him hurt. But I'm going to say sorry in the first place because I'm going to instigate it.
Hmm. Interesting, because it kind of sounds like maybe you're talking about that opponent might be in the same position that Jess is in, that she is having
some
to do
sort
things,
of pawn. Yeah.
Having to do things to Sam that maybe doesn't really want to do, but also isn't maybe in control of her own free will. What did you think, Paul?
That's how I read it. Just sorry that I put you in the middle of all of this.
Sorry you have to go through it.
Yeah, not so much the Larry part, the whole dragging you onto this island. She's apologizing for that.
When Jason is holding Sam at shotgun point in the forest and talking about the rage and wanting to give into it, and mentions I lost a child, Sam, I think like we all did, and says, because of you, I lost a child because of you. Sam obviously takes that as Epona dying. But later on, the Martins say that he lost a son, another son lost, like Sam, but to a combine, which gruesome. Also, there's farming going on here on the island.
I know. Question mark, question mark. They're clearly a fishing.
We have every other kind of fucking, you know, biome. Why wouldn't we have a farm?
Dude, we never see anything like that. They're clearly a fishing village and then like maybe a small garden, but no fucking combines.
Come on, guys. Why the oysters are dead, because they're using a fucking combine on the oyster beds.
I disagree. I think that was a total absolute fucking lie. And I do think they lost, you know, he lost his daughter to this cult is my thinking.
Oh, okay. So you think a spiritual loss or a metaphor, like a loss that...
Yeah, that she's...
Like
actually, that she's... Yeah, yeah. And again,
you don't think she's like a zombie child? You
oh,
think
well,
that-
I don't know. I do not know. I don't know her full extent of life. I really don't, because she stayed very zipped up to her neck. If you guys notice, like, even though everyone else is wearing kind of like free open clothes, like Jess has very open shirt, like unbuttoned and stuff, but Aponia's stuff is like zipped up to her neck. I don't know.
She was still wearing the bear shirt. When she appears on the stairwell inside the room when you know, oh, you are a silly little sausage, that whole scene, and they reveal that Epona's standing there, she's still wearing the bear shirt.
That all feels wrong.
There's
weird.
No clothes on it. Like, you're this girl who hung herself, you can't get her a new fucking shirt to wear over the next day?
Yeah, no. Mm-mm.
Come on. What did you think, Paul? Did he really lose his son? Were they talking about Epona?
The explanation from Mr. Martin, of course, felt convenient and... only partially true. He blames everyone. Stuff just was unprovable enough to just slather on as an excuse.
To play on Sam's already weakness by making a son, a young son lost just like you, to make that same kind of connection again. Right? There's a lot of attempts at connecting to Sam.
Well, and that happened during the whole refuting Sam's explanations of the day scene in the kitchen where they bring in, I believe they're called the Sajura, the people in the fish costumes. They were clearly boys. The men chasing him were clearly men. But how do you make that argument with these people that are stacking up all these cross arguments?
Gaslighting that, like crazy. Yeah.
Everyone is telling you you're crazy, and when you're already kind of not so stable, you start to doubt yourself, and I think that's exactly what they're trying to do. They know he's kind of in this fragile state to begin with, so they just have to tell him he's wrong and he's crazy enough, and maybe he'll move past it. Like, they didn't address the fact that Jason said, I lost a child because of you. How would him losing a son in a combine be because of Sam in any kind of... Was Sam driving the combine?
Right. They just give that generic everyone. He blames everyone. No, I disagree. I definitely feel like it's the whole Epona is a part of some sort of scheme to lure Sam, and her part included doing things that Jason would be upset about, and that pulled her away from him, and now she's lost to the cause over here.
That would explain why she's at the big house rather than Jason's house.
Yes, because she's a part of the big plan over here, whatever's going on.
The big house plan.
Hey, but you know what? Side note, just because I saw this, I didn't go research this, but I saw it. Do you guys know where gaslighting comes from, that idea? It was actually a play. What the husband does to gaslight his wife is where the term comes from, is he gradually turned down the lights in the house incrementally, but denied every time she would say, doesn't it seem darker in here? He'd be like, no, it seems exactly the same. And just does that over and over and over until she feels like she's going crazy. That's what gaslighting is. It's a literal turning down of the lights.
That's very interesting. I did not know that.
It's one of the many things he does.
I associate it with the San Diego district right outside of where Comic-Con takes place, is the Gaslight
that
district.
That is so. Not it.
Well, you know, when I was there, I felt like they turned the lights down a little bit.
And then did someone say, no, Mike, all the lights are on. You're wrong.
So they really were. And then when I said, someone told me, they said there was no one there. And I said, shut up, you're lying!
You're like, no.
And I woke up in a bear shirt covered in blood.
San Diego!
Oh, my God.
I was the only one there for Comic-Con this year. I had a great time.
Got into everything you wanted to get into.
Let's talk about the big house, and let's talk about the tent revival. Praise Jesus, we're holding church on Saturday. What in the loving God was going on in this tent?
It looked like a very heal this man kind of moment. I mean, Paul and I have seen a lot of evangelists going on. This is a very southern looking thing out there.
Oh, for sure. They're fanning themselves. They're giving amens from the seats. But the problem is the preacher is mixing in Bible passages, a little incoherently, but he's mixing in Bible passages, but he's also mixing in some of the kind of pagan idolism that we learn about in this episode. So there's a mixture of stuff going on here. This is a very specific kind of OC Christianity. This is not Catholicism the way I understand it, or any other kind of Christian sect the way I understand it. You know, I'll spare you guys, and maybe I'll make a post about it. I mean, he quotes from Ezekiel, he quotes from Revelation. It's some interesting stuff that they're talking about. They're talking about all the God smiting stuff that's going to happen, right? I will fill your mountains with the dead, your hills, your valleys, your ravines will be filled with people sword by the sword. That's not good stuff. That's like making war stuff. What is Jason being punished for, do you guys think? Did you have any kind of sense of what was happening here, that he was being kind of publicly flogged? That so much so that they need to drown him to save him?
Yeah, he interfered with their plan. He came up and yelled at Aponia and said, hey, you can't be doing that anymore. And he's trying to pull his daughter out, who's a part of apparently a linchpin in their plan. So whatever their big scheme is, whatever they think they're doing and why they think they're doing it, I mean, they feel they're righteous in whatever this path is. And so anyone who comes in, whether it's Mimir or whether it's Jason, whomever is going to step in and say like, hey, I don't want this person involved. Yeah, that person's a fucking cock block. They want them out. They're sinners for doing that.
Do you suppose this is the manifestation of that anti-Christian church that we've seen evidence of with the
reverse cross
and
I do
other stuff around? Do you think this is just what it looks like out in the daylight?
Yeah, I think this is like the public face of it. This is, you know,
sorry.
I feel Jesus up in his chili. Let's go.
The Roxy.
Wow. All my volumes are off. I don't understand.
It's Eliza from Next is trying to get to you. I think this is the public face of the anti-Jesus cult. Just because I love salt talk.
This is Salt Corner with Mike. Salty, salty corner.
Right. Today on NACL, we're talking sweet, sweet salt. The I will fill your mountains with the dead is from Ezekiel 35, verses 8 through 10. There is another part of Ezekiel, which is one of the prophet books from the Old Testament, in chapter 43, says, you shall present them before the Lord, and the priests shall sprinkle salt on them and offer them up as a burnt offering to the Lord. Again, we talked about last week how salt is always part of the sacrifices and all part of the offerings. When the our duo is having their little acid trip and they're watching the dry run of the parade, they're throwing salt. They're sprinkling salt on the ground. They're salting the earth, real literally. And they're throwing salt all around. And again, just this imagery of this island and salt being kind of put to play as like a weapon. So I just thought it was interesting. Again, you know, we're pulling from this prophetic book in the Bible and go a little bit further into Ezekiel from where the preacher was, and he's talking about, you know, the burnt offerings to the Lord and sprinkling salt on them. And it's just another use of the salt imagery. But let's get to the Jesus Trinity, because this is Jess's big thing. When Sam wants to switch the conversation from his dead son on the beach, she starts talking about Jesus and the other kind of pagan gods, the Celtic gods that are at play in the island. Did you guys dig this at all? I don't know that you guys have any kind of big, like, deep dive feel for the religion stuff like I'm kind of obsessed with. But what did you guys think of that whole passage about the sacrifice and the history of the island?
Well, first of all, if we were the Ghostbusters, I think you'd be Ray.
Yeah.
He's totally Ray.
No, not Ray. No, he's yeah. No, he's
Is Ray Dan Aykroyd?
Yes. Yeah, you're not Ray.
Oh, I would want to be Spengler.
You are Spengler without
Spengler's
a doubt.
Who I'd want to be.
He's like the nerdy one.
Yeah, but Ray's the one that brings in the biblical depth. He even
he
quotes
does
it.
Get he does get the ghost blowjob, and that's kind of hard.
No, sorry, Spengler. I'm the Venkman.
I don't think we were disputing that.
Oh my God. Anyway, so
I want to be Annie Potts, but what did you think of it?
I'm with you wholeheartedly. I think this religious aspect gives it a ton of depth. I was kind of laughing to myself about the idea that, like, we have Jesus, which is not a super common name, and then we have to go with Jesus, which I know this is like the thing, but like, that's so silly. It's like, oh, I'm the opposite. It's like, I don't know. It just sounds so silly. Right.
Satan and Stan, right?
Yes, it sounds so funny. I was like, oh, that sounds so funny. I think this was a very cool thing to have here. I think this is the type of thing that gives you like interest in a show that gives you a chance to go do some research. And then also, everything's always a little more scary if there's a little bit of truth to it. If there's a little bit of like, this really happened. People really did do this here. They really did do sacrifices. That makes it really scarier for me. So I love it. How about you, Paul? Are you liking the religious stuff?
I do enjoy that element of pulling just enough stuff that you could research and get some depth to in the real world. And then they start to add on their own mythology to make it work for the story. The part where you might get some people all up in arms about something, I enjoy that aspect, actually. The idea that there's a perversion of the religion in a way that works for the show that would scare people in real life. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes it more scary because it's got a basis of real truth.
Right. Because it's not such a far throw, especially in this world, this fractured world. You could probably find 93 people in a planet of 6 billion, oh, 7 yeah. billion to, yeah. you know, that would be into this. Yeah, I like that it's a real thing because no one really talks about, especially no one really talks about Celtic mythology. You know, you get leprechauns. That's like the most like kind of mythology you get, and maybe some banshees, but you don't get a lot of like, you know, of this stuff on TV. But we've got Epona, you know, we have, you know, Jesus. And last week we talked about Jesus is kind of like the anti-Jesus, right? He is a warrior woodsman. A couple of depictions that exist are him cutting branches down and cutting trees down. The episode, I think, was really smart because it starts with the menu that has the depiction of Jesus cutting at the branch that's holding Jesus hanging from it in his crucifixion pose. What a wild depiction of Jesus hanging, but with a T pose. That's insane to me. And why would you have that in your bar menu?
Just a lighthearted sketch, you know.
Yeah.
Like conversation Mr. Martin tells you, it's for the tourists. That's why we have all this shit around the bar. It's for the tourists.
I like that they went back to that. The Jack the Ripper, mm-hmm. They clarified that there were Jack the Ripper's victims on the wall.
Yeah, but it's just for the tourists. He's always got a reason, Mike. It's like, oh, what you gonna do? It's for the tourism.
So, you know, just calling back to last week's episode, talked about how Jesus is known for his loving kind, you know, inclusive nature. And Jesus, when you look at the poem that the first mention of him from the Pharsalia by the Roman poet Lucan, it's described as cruel, savage, and demanding. The idea that they demand sacrifice, Jesus and his two buddies, Teutates and Tyrannus. And this is what Jess gets into on the island, but I looked into it a little bit. What she describes is kind of what the idea is, or at least is, there's not a lot written here. So the show embellished what it seems to be known about these three, this trinity. But I really like the idea that there are priests that dress up like creatures from the sea and lure people and sacrifice them to appease these three gods.
What should we think about you that you really like that?
Oh, I thought it was so fascinating. Well, because here's where my tinfoil hat is, and I need you guys to come along with me, or else I'm going to be talking to myself, and that's really sad.
He's moving the dresser right now,
okay,
people.
Okay, all right. He's asking for help.
I need your help.
Okay, we're all right. Listening. Let's all right, see. So, we're helping.
So Jess dropped some exposition, which seems like just filler, but I think it's exposition. Tyrannus, one of the three Trinity gods, he requires sacrifices by drowning. Teutates requires sacrifices by fire. Jesus requires sacrifices by hanging. I think we have seen all of these sacrifices in the show. I think the drowning is maybe Jason.
The drowning is Nathan.
Ooh.
No, well.
Yes, he was found in the river.
Okay, well, that works, but because the preacher is talking about how he has to be drowned until he's saved.
Maybe so. Maybe it's Jason, but I'm going with what we've seen and what we've been told is like, I'm going with you, Nathan. I like what you're going here. Nathan, I'm putting in that spot.
Oh, Nathan works also, but I think Jason just the whole, because he's pissed off, because he is pissed off the Colonel Sanders and the island elderman, he seemed ripe to be for the drowning. And the preacher saying a lot in different ways, you know, we have to drown him until he's clean. He seemed like he was prime, but I do like Nathan. That makes sense. The sacrifice by fire, Goltan. Burned in the camper. We saw it in this episode. Mm-hmm. Or maybe we saw it in this episode, right? We know someone was thumping on that camper.
Someone was
locked
thumping
in there.
Yes.
Right? Sacrifice of fire. And the reason I think the island is mad at Sam, the reason everyone's pissed off about Epona, is that she was supposed to be the sacrifice for hanging. I think she was supposed to be the Azus sacrifice. And it got all fucked up. And I think that's why the big house is mad. I think that's why they're up in arms. I think that's why everyone's given the stink eye, led by Larry. I think Larry is one of these priests who dress up like a little fish sea creature and lures people to do the sacrifice. It all kind of made sense to me when I was watching the episode. That's why him and his band of men are walking around with their fish head on. They're the creatures. They're the priests that Jess is talking about on the beach that would lure the people to make the sacrifices. Sam fucked it all up. He fucked it all up by saving Epona. She was supposed to die by hanging as a sacrifice for the island, for the gods. Because they need the festival to go well, guys. They need it to go well.
But I'm going to go with the conflicting part, right? So what if one group wanted her to hang and have that happen? And what if she, like, what if the choosing of the spot and everything goes along with, but we knew he would be there and blah, 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 and he would save her, and that would lure him over to the island and perhaps, you know, change the course of what was happening here.
I think there's support for that. Okay. Mrs. Martin, when she gives him the orange sneakers, she says to him, we need this festival to go well. We're on our knees, but we won't put the festival ahead of her well-being. Well, that's Miss Martin saying that, but I don't know that the island feels that way. I think the island or the island
or
elders
the Larrys
are
and
willing.
Mr. Martin's.
And the Colonel Sanders. I think they're very much willing to put the island's needs ahead of Epona's. Mrs. Martin is the one who seems to maybe feel that they're going to try and save Epona over the island. But I think Epona's headed for the gallows. I think that's her. Her destiny on the island. What do you think, Paul? Am I wearing a tinfoil hat? Am I using red string? Am I a meme?
No, I think you're probably onto something. Blanket agreement on that.
Well, you know, until we prove wrong, at least it makes it super interesting to me, because you don't get a lot of defense of sacrifices. You know, you don't get a lot of people making, you know, informed arguments on why sacrifices and hanging and fire and drowning are great things. But it seems like we've got some people on OC Island who may be in the market for that. So
the idea of the two factions, though, especially where it comes to the Martins, it makes so much sense how there's just complete opposites, and how the woman keeps calling him shit for brains and stuff like that. And he's just like, meh. And that's a very good chance of that being the case.
One of my favorite moments with them, which they got almost a little slapsticky in this moment, was when they were in the kitchen and Mr. Martin brings in the tray of tea and he's like, hey, if I made this tea and I put a little spot of whiskey in it. And she was like, well, she said, quit being an asshole or something like that. And he literally turns on his heel and takes the tray out of the room. It was so like Three Stooges-y. Like, it was so funny. Like, it was so like, oh my God, way to somehow add a little bit of humor to this weird ass moment.
I gotta tell you, Mr. Martin has a real turn of phrase at the beginning of the episode when he says that he's gonna give them the full English.
I know.
I don't know that I've heard anything sound dirtier.
Every time he said it, every time he was like, oh, I'm gonna give it to you good. I'm gonna give it to you real good. It was like, oh my God, what is with him?
Gonna give you the full English. Like, oh, hey-o.
It sounded like a lot.
I want to put on another tinfoil theory based on you not thinking they had sex, Caroline, because he makes very clear that he did not wake Sam up, because he intimates he went to the door and heard the and could not disturb them in the middle of their throes. One, they're still fucking at 7 a.m. when he's supposed to be getting up. Good for them. Two, It would seem if they did not have sex, but you wanted to make it look like you had sex, mm-hmm. that you would go in the overabundant dispersal of clothes and maybe take Sam's boots, which we haven't even talked about. Who took Sam's boots? Maybe Mr. Martin set that room up while they were both passed the fuck out to make it look like they had sex, which would put them on this path together, make this bond form together. What do you think about that?
I absolutely 100% feel he did not hear shit and that those people were passed out. Most of us have had a moment where we drank a lot and we don't necessarily remember everything, but shit. Come on. I mean, I don't know how to say it any differently. You're tired. How about that? There's a lot of tiredness and, you know, good on Jude Law if he can get it up and be that fucking wasted.
I think he wanted to keep Sam on the island.
Of course.
So yeah.
And it was a shame moment, right? Because how could Sam dispute that? He couldn't remember. But it throws them together, though, also, right?
It gives him a reason. Now he has this bond to this woman. Maybe it makes it harder for him to stay. And in the end, it does make it hard for him to leave. He doesn't. Because one of the things that struck me was aggressive dispersal of clothes. That's what I wrote in my notes. The idea that Mr. Martin went in there and did that with their clothing makes a lot more sense to me than them doing that in the throes of passion. Like, there are fucking clothes everywhere in that scene. And in a way that doesn't make any sense unless you went in there.
They're not naked in the bed. How about that? Why are there clothes everywhere, but then they're not? Okay, but he's not there. I'm just saying, like,
right.
What is all this extra clothing?
Right, well, because he went in there, probably went through their things and was like, I'm going to fling it everywhere. There's going to be three pairs of underwear because she was wearing three pairs of underwear the night before. And, you know, she was wearing six tops. And yeah, so it makes a lot of sense when you look at it from that, when you think about it.
Where his boots are? That's a good question when you ask that. Didn't we learn from Lost, but from many, many, many other shows, O.J. Simpson? If those Brunos, what are they? Bruno what? It's like something with an M.
Molly?
Yeah, his shoes. If his shoes, they could find like a shoe print somewhere, then that would prove that Sam had been somewhere. And if his shoes were missing, you could definitely go stomp around somewhere and then claim he was over there. Plus, I think it just makes you like, I mean, God, could you have a more literal, you can't leave? You don't have any fucking shoes.
Or it also puts you in the island's shoes. I mean, Mrs. Martin, who we're saying is maybe Team Sam, it hands them to him, but they're the island's shoes for all intents and purposes. And now he's wearing their clothes. Maybe there's a tracker in there. Who knows? They're bright orange for sure.
She is not Team Sam. Not Team Sam.
You don't think Miss Martin is?
Nope.
If we're saying Mr. Martin is not Team Sam and we're saying they're a yin yang, that's why I was thinking that maybe she is a salty protector.
I think that Mr. Martin is willing to strong arm Sam into doing whatever with like the Larrys of the world, because those are like his henchmen and like part of that whole cult biz, right? Over there. And Mrs. Martin's trying to convince him to do the same thing. She's just trying to do it in a different way. She's trying to do it in like a, you know, you catch more flies with honey. They're both manipulating him. She's not driving him across the causeway.
That's true.
She's talking about grief. Grief's
such... Yeah, she's all leaning into it. Stay here. Be cool. It's fine.
Maybe she's going to want him to strike down the big house. And, you know, maybe that's her end.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that...
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's two factions on the island, and Sam's come in on this sitch. Everybody has something to want to do with Sam, but they're not necessarily...
No one's looking out for him, right?
No. Nobody's for Team Sam. Nobody cares how he feels about it at the end.
I mean, to be honest, I don't know that Team Sam is Team Sam, honestly. I mean...
he's trying to figure out what the fuck to do.
Man, I think we tackled another dense episode, yeah.
It was. It was super dense. You guys, I have got to talk about the fact that after episode 3, after our next episode, they are going to be doing this really amazing rollout of an episode in October, I believe it's on the 3rd, where the third day is doing this 12-hour episode. It's not going to be on HBO, which is important for everyone to know. You have to know that if you're interested in checking this out, you're going to have to check it out online. It is going to be live on the island, and they're going to have certain things that have to happen throughout the episode, but otherwise it is a lot of ad-lib and just sort of like watching them go through these ritualistic moments. They said that there's a ritual that has to happen and there's certain steps to the ritual, but how it all gets to those different points is just going to happen organically. That whole section, that 12-hour thing, is being called Autumn. So it's between our, like, we have summer right now, and then the last three episodes are winter. This is the autumn section. This sounds fascinating. It is on October 3rd. It is only online. Originally, before COVID, they were going to have all kinds of fans be allowed to come and be actually interactive with the villagers, because I think it's supposed to be the festival. So it would have been a music festival. So they would have allowed all of us to show up on OC and hang out and do stuff and interact with them. Murder mystery style, where like certain characters have to say certain things to certain other characters at different points. I think this sounds like so freaking fascinating. I don't know how any of us are watching 12 hours of this, like as if it's a live feed. And that's what Jude Law said. He said they're not even stopping to let them go to the bathroom or eat. They're eating on camera. And he said, I might have to duck behind a bush to pee or something. And he literally said, the quote was, I'll have to control myself, because it follows Sam the whole time. So guys, what do you think of this?
Well, we'll need more details to give to listeners in terms of like how to find it. I think it'll be different depending on where you are. If you're in the UK, I think it's going to be one way. If you're outside, it's going to be some other way. I don't know. Like, we're HBO Max subscribers, so I...
No, it says it's not going to be on HBO at all. It's going to be on... Mike, what is it? The British one? Sky, whatever?
Sky, yes.
And it's all online. It says it's not HBO.
Huh.
Not going to be a part of
HBO. Availability might be an issue, but we're going to try to get to the bottom of that before it happens.
I'm super curious, too, about the timing. If it's live and it's 12 hours and it's going on in England, what does that mean for all of us over here? When are we watching this? In the middle of the night? Yes, that's how it works. I know from Diana's funeral. I know it's going to be the middle of the night. So I'm like, well, this is very interesting.
Well, or the, if it's night. There, but I guess 12 hours is a long time, so it would cover.
Maybe it will be. I mean, it's a nighttime festival, I assume. Well, it'll be an all-day nighttime festival, right?
Yeah.
I mean, festivals are probably most fun at night. Mike, what do you think of this wild?
I love it. Listen, I'm a big theater guy. Before the COVID times, I was at Broadway literally as much as possible. I love live theater. I love live concerts. They are my favorite things to go do. I don't know that I could commit to 12 hours of watching this, but I can put in some serious mileage watching people kind of improv and follow a loose narrative. Definitely, especially with this cast, because I think this is actually a very talented cast of people. From what I understand, it's going to be kind of a bridge between this summer story and leading us into the winter story. While being its own self-contained story, like the other two segments, it's also going to be a bridge between them. So you kind of understand what's going on. I'm all for that. I love any kind of multimedia presentation, not to talk about Lost again, but when Lost was on and they, launched the whole Dharma Initiative online, I spent a lot of time being part of Dharma. Like, I'm all in on multimedia consumption. So.
I'm super fan as well as getting audience members involved. There was another show, which one was it, where we had like the guns and the weapons and you could see it on the screen at the same time as it was happening? Was it Westworld? What one was it?
I know Colony had some things that they had that you could participate with along.
As it was happening in the episode. Like, they would ask you something. Remember, you had to answer.
Yeah, and they had little games that you could play.
Yeah, I mean, I think that stuff's all cool. I mean, I think you have to do it in order to be, like, interesting these days. You have to find some other little ways to pull people in. Mike, this speaks to you. Listen to this. It says, given the length of the episode and its focus on, get this, rituals, traditions, and pageantry. What? I love pageantry, and you're all about the rest of that.
That's literally like my middle name is, rituals. So that's what the R stands for.
It's what you stood very clearly on in this episode, is that you enjoy the religious and the ritual aspects.
I love the religion rituals. No, there's nothing about this that I am not 100% behind. I think it sounds fantastic.
We have to find out a way if we can record it or something so that people can watch it.
One of the things we said last week was that this show is not just a limited series. It really is kind of an event, and it almost feels like an avant-garde art installment in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Just the way, though, this episode maybe even doubled down even more so on crazy camera and the out of focus and the drunk and the high and really trippy camera work and I think they're breaking so many rules, traditional rules of filmmaking. I fully expect the live theater aspect to be just as kind of wild. So I'm all for it.
Yeah, we didn't even mention a lot about the acid trip, particularly around the bonfire when the Martins come to get him. We had to rewind it to be like, are those people's faces distorted or
they really were.
What? And some of them were, some of them weren't. Maybe just the island folk were wearing kind of these weird...
Like white masks, almost like
semi-human masks.
But almost like pantyhose masks, like that kind where it like distorts your features, but like it's still a face.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, super weird. And then she drags him away, and then there's all that it's kind of people floating around.
And then they're floating. And then, like, you don't even realize because they're in the background, they're in the air. But then they're up in the air, too. And then they come back down. It was really well done. Yeah. You know, we talked about last week how there were a couple of scenes in the first episode where I felt like it was like a painting and then they were just moving through the painting, almost like a set, like a play set on like a stage where there's like a painted background and you're just moving kind of in front of it. There were several scenes where Jess and Sam are moving and it looks like it's just a painted background that they're walking in front of. Really, really kind of trippy stuff. And then the trees growing, like sprouting, almost like tumors, and the spider beetles returned in a way that made it look like a time elapsed hatching kind of thing. Yeah, some really crazy photographic things happening in the acid scene. That takes us to the end of another episode of The Third Day. I've never done drugs, but I feel like I had a contact high with this episode. Thank you guys so much for listening. Please don't forget to subscribe to Pod Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts and leave a review, 5 stars. And we'll see you next week when we, you know, get high again with you.
If you prefer Amazon Music, you can catch us there, too.
Go check us out on the brand new We Were One of the Launch Day podcasts, Pod Clubhouse was, and you can get us there. Subscribe wherever you listen to us. Please subscribe. Please leave a review. 5 stars, 5 stars, 5 stars. And we'd love to hear from you. Let us know what you think about the show.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.